How is this book, as Mary Shibas calls it, a field guide?
That's a good question. I feel like it's a field guide to my own interior, which is not a territory that I was comfortable navigating before I wrote this book.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Rob Schlegel about his collection of poetry, In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps, winner of the Iowa Poetry Prize. This program was recorded in Spokane, Washington during their Get Lit Literary Festival with the generous support from Spokane Public Radio. This program also contains adult language for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. You begin with an oracle. Language is where you live in mere fidelity to narrative, she says, but language is not my first language. Rob, what is your first language?
I feel like I'm more visual. So images seem more comfortable for me to exist in. And then part of the beauty of poetry is that you can use images to inform language. And what's also great is that language, I think, informs the way that I see. Language informs the way that I conceive of an image. So it's like a two-way street, which is exciting and unexpected.
I was hoping you would start by reading Nature Breeds a Promise-Keeping Animal.
Nature Breeds a Promise-Keeping Animal. Pointing to the dead rabbit, my daughter says rock. Dogs circle dirt where murder wore the grass away. Absolute arrangement on Lewis Street. Wind ruins the volunteer maples near the lake through which I'm free to wade, watching my daughter on shore drawing circles on paper, mindful of the white space. A different kind of freedom is throwing rocks into the lake and knowing the lake's response.
I want to know what the dialogue is that you're having with nature, specifically with trees.
Specifically with trees. When a lot of this book was written, I was living in Portland, Oregon, and trees are everywhere there. Trees are everywhere where I've lived, out west at least. And they became kind of ubiquitous in the sense that they were everywhere, and I would sort of fail to see them in the same way that I failed to see people. And I realized this last year, as the end of the book was sort of coming together, one of the last poems I wrote is called 52 Trees. It's essentially a catalog of trees that I imagine in some ways represent humans. So I've given them, a lot of them, human characteristics. And the process of writing that poem kind of made me realize that I was not seeing the people in my life in ways that they needed to be seen, which is to say, I wasn't as present as I needed to be as a father and a spouse and a brother and a son and a friend, I think, as well. So these were all realizations that emerged after kind of just slowing down and starting to see people and starting to see these trees as individuals, which I think is something that's easy to think that it's easy to do, but it's not often.
At the very end of your acknowledgments, you address Keisha, your wife. Keisha, thank you for seeing me how I wish to be seen.
Yeah.
What is the capacity in your relationship as writers that cultivates the ability to see each other? And maybe writing has nothing to do with it.
I think writing does have something to do with it. I don't know exactly what that is, but it feels like sometimes when I'm in the midst of writing a poem, the attention the poem requires is equivalent to the attention a human requires. And as the spouse of another writer, there's a kind of acknowledgement that we can each give our full attention to our work, so we better, sure as hell, like, be able to give it to each other. That's been a source of generative tension for me. I don't know if Keisha would call it a source of generative tension, but it has, being a spouse to anyone is something that means you're something to that person, like you're defined in a sense. I've always been hesitant to be defined, and this started, I think, the first time I was aware of that kind of desire to not be defined was as a baseball player and an athlete. It's who I was. It was sort of my identity for almost two decades. And then I resisted that definition after a while and sort of resisted all definitions for a while. So then when you become a parent, when you become a spouse, it's like you're sort of put into another kind of box. This is who you are. This is what you do. I felt like I needed to resist that too. So writing poetry sometimes felt like an outlet.
I'm glad you brought up definitions and naming. One of your lines, I'm going to call it a soon-to-be-famous line, is, "The meaning I'm trying to protect is the heart is neither boy nor girl." What's the conversation you're having with gender and sexuality in the book?
It feels like a conversation for me that's very alive within myself as a parent of a boy and a girl. I'm seeing how my expectations of what it means to be gendered are having an influence on them. And that means that the way that my parents thought about what it means to be gendered had a pretty significant influence on me. I just think everything is over-gendered, and I don't think that that's that radical of a way of thinking, but it can be, I think, a little disarming to some people to think that gender is a little bit more of a spectrum than maybe we were taught as children in the 80s and other decades, at least in the household that I grew up in. I know that a lot of other households are probably very different. So with that kind of labeling and sort of excessive labeling of gender, I feel like we do a lot of damage, or we can do a lot of damage to young people who are still very much wandering around in their human bodies.
Will you read the sixth section from the long poem Threat Perception?
Will and I paint our fingernails. I know a Nietzsche scholar who also paints his nails, I say. Will's face twists into a dried apricot, as if warning, don't realize me, or we might tumble together, depersonalized. Let us treat each other well, as if we are real. Perhaps we are, I want to say, even as I fear for him. that all his life he'll walk alone into the flames of a singular rage.
What's the singular rage?
Sometimes I think it's masculinity, toxic masculinity. And sometimes I worry that it's something more specific or more something more personal to my son. It's my imagination worrying or allowing me to worry about his future because his anger is something that seems foreign to me or that seems a little bit outside of my understanding of how I access anger and my own feelings. I almost sometimes think his relationship to anger is maybe healthier than mine because he has easier access to it, maybe. Maybe I don't allow myself to feel angry sometimes. Sometimes I just feel like I don't get that angry other times.
On the back of the book, it reads, "With calm abandon, Rob Schlegel stands among the genderless trees to shake notions of masculinity and fatherhood." And that the book is a tender search for the mother in the father, the poet in the parent, the forest in the human. And I wanted to know, for your children, in terms of identity, what's the open field you want them to be able to play in?
In terms of gender?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like for them to feel like they don't need to be something for somebody else. I want them to feel like they can be who they are and not become something that somebody else thinks they should be, which seems so basic. But I feel like the fewer expectations a parent places on a child, the better, generally. At the same time, I think it's useful for kids to have structure and for children to have structure. But I also think that too much of that can be really harmful. I think it can be extremely harmful in some situations where a child is really questioning a lot of their own experience with their bodies.
You begin one poem with the line, "As a father who wishes to be a mother." Can you just talk more about your experience of being a parent and being a poet?
I feel like this is potentially dangerous territory because I am male and I identify as male. And there's a kind of romanticizing of the mother that I'm wary of because I don't want to, I guess that line has the potential to read like something where I'm sort of fetishizing motherhood. And I haven't quite worked my way around that idea yet, but it's not something that I think I'm wanting to fetishize. It feels more like something that I want to respect as deeply as possible as a role that someone might have in a household, no matter their gender. And I guess maybe that's the point I want to get to, is that the love that Keisha shows our children and the patience that she shows them is something that I admire deeply. So on a very personal, sort of local level, it's not that I just want to be a mother as a father, it's that I want to be the kind of mother that Keisha is, or I want to be the father. I want to be the Keisha version of the father that I am, if that makes any sense.
you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Rob Schlegel about his collection of poems, In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Checked your Twitter feed, and there was this captivating line where you wrote, "Today we celebrated my son's birthday. Before the cake part, I overheard him say to a friend, 'It's sad having a poet for a dad.'" And then, of course, you write, "Hashtag April is the cruelest" from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. How do you interpret that?
My son speaks in verse. I can't figure out where language comes from for him. Well, I say that and then I think, well,
the child of two writers.
He's the child of two writers. He says he hates poetry and he thinks that it's pointless. He's been saying this for the last year or two. The way that I've been interpreting that is that he's fearful of the attention that I give it because I'm not giving that attention to him. And that's kind of breaks my heart. But I feel like that's the way that I've contextualized his disdain for poetry. Otherwise, I'm not sure where it's coming from other than a rebellious streak. But yeah, for now, I'm letting him hate poetry as much as he wants. Although I am planning to go into his classroom and do some poetry lessons for him in a couple of weeks for him and his classmates.
That's great. Was there a point in writing the book where you felt your heart palpitate more than normal?
Yeah, one poem that felt like consistent heart palpitations was Searches. It was a poem that was written during a very anxious time for me. One of the things that I remember about the 2 or 3 months during which that poem was written was that I was being observed and then reviewed as an instructor. So that was sort of one contributing anxiety during that time. So in that way, they weren't joyful heart palpitations. They were like stressful heart palpitations. So I felt like that poem allowed me to work through a lot of that in some way.
Will you read part of it?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Searches. Why do I cry after sex? Can I eat old chocolate? Will juniper berries make me crazy? Can I really eat breakfast at Tiffany's? What if an asteroid? What if a metroid? How do moons sex? Does bonsai sex? Is it true you don't choose who you love? What does sugar say? What says Genesis? Oh, brave little engine, where is your aorta? Am I addicted, quiz? Can I take my dog's Triptanol? Can I buy a house with a credit card? How does Nike f***? Was John Ashbery? When did Reagan walk the earth? Can I deep fry Dayquil? Oh, brave little engine, where is your pituitary? What if my toddler ate my Zoloft? Is it okay to take pictures at a wake? When should I give my therapist a gift? Is it normal for cats to pant? What are symptoms of candida? How does Sony f***? Does the internet make me depressed? Is it okay the police? Does America own the moon? Oh, brave little engine, where are your ovaries? Does gravity bend light? Can I eat Lucifer's wife? And what wonders is she sitting on over there? Do my coworkers like me, quiz? What if I were famous, Vine? Is my son's Vader helmet more vitally alive when it's in the closet, no longer reduced to the context in which it was made? How does the cloud f**k? What if Brandon was a dinosaur? What if Dot was a sea cucumber? What if America's dad? What if I was a girl? Is intuition good or bad? Will I die before my children? Is glass even a thing? A falling stone endeavors to continue in its motion. What if a bullet? Is brain future-proof? When am I going to feel okay? Are you there? It's me, Robbie. How does this phone work? How do you know?
The oracle of the internet. Why do you think we turn to it to ask these types of questions?
Because there's the feeling that it might not judge us. That's maybe why I turned to it to ask these questions. That's why I turned to this poem to ask these questions, because I felt like being anonymous in front of the internet is easy. And I felt like I could ask some of these questions if I imagine myself asking these questions to a screen that wouldn't judge me in the way that people judge. And that's a dangerous place to go, I think, because it implies the only place you can go is the internet to not be judged. And that isn't true. You just have to be open and honest with the right people, I think.
I'm going to ask you a real life living oracle. Is it true you don't choose who you love?
Yeah, I think it is. If we could just get out of the way of ourselves, I think there would be a little bit more harmony between couples.
I'm going to change gears. There's a voice of yours that comes in the long poem Threat Perception, and I really was struck by it, and I was hoping you would read the second section.
Safeway's a total bust. They sell the deadest meat. I end up spending way too much on salmon smoked industrially. Lindy's down the aisle calling for me. Poppy, are you hiding? Greens wilt into greens, misters crisp to fresh. What fiction? Fingers in mint I mistake for rosemary. What aisle is this? Forecast calls for blow. Someone else's turn to care. That dad melting brie in the marvelous glitter of his mouth.
Where does this sass come from in you?
I think the sass comes from... I think everyone has a little sass. And it took me two books to realize that the sass has a place in my poetry. It started to emerge in my poetry in my second book. My second book was maybe almost overwhelmed by that sass. In this book, that tone feels a little more measured and a little bit less angry at things that are beyond my control. My second book, I think, spent a lot of time sort of in the critical mode toward my country and where I live as a U.S. citizen during the Bush era, essentially. And the sass now is gazing directly at what it means to be a father and a spouse, and it's looking directly at domesticity and how mundane domesticity can be and how soul withering domesticity can be, it just felt appropriate.
If this book could magically transform into a key and land in the hand of someone who really needs it to unlock themselves, who would that person be?
My first answer is who I was 6 years ago. My second answer is a person who is maybe thinking of a different way to be male, a way that's less, maybe a different way to be male, and a way that's less invested in maintaining stoicism and maintaining a kind of distance from the emotional landscape that is a major part of what it means to be human. It's taken me several years to sort of begin to feel comfortable in that space, and I feel like this book is sort of a chronicling of that journey.
Rob Schlegel lives in Washington with his spouse and children. He's the winner of two prior awards for his collections of poetry, The Lesser Fields and January Machine. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.